Chapter 4. Prognostication, Panic, and Scientific Progress. Early writings make a good case, or at least a solidly arguable case, that ancient cultures such as the Egyptians, Hittites, Anatolians, and Chinese were reasonably aware that the source of rocks falling from the sky was, well, the sky. People of the ancient world did not seem to have a great deal of difficulty believing that rocks could originate from outside the confines of Mother Earth, and yet still land on her. Sure, sometimes meteorites were mistakenly thought to be messages from demons or gods. Or in the case of the more modern Aztecs, meteorites were believed to be divine excrements. And while thinking about my chosen field of study as godly poopology makes me chuckle a bit. At least the Aztecs correctly deduced the hypersonic turds from the sky were of extraterrestrial origin, and not just fast-moving, locally sourced turds somehow blowing around the atmosphere. The same cannot be said for learned academia for the better part of the last two millennia. And the reason for this massive misunderstanding, at least for me, is quite surprising. One might think that it was primarily a religious reason falling rocks were dismissed as coming from somewhere beyond Earth, but it was almost the opposite of that. In most academic circles, the belief that rocks fell from outer space was held back by an over-reliance on a few brilliant scientific minds, starting at the height of classical Greek civilization. This conviction of an earthly source of falling stones, again, oddly, was compounded by the even more brilliant and even more scientific minds yet to come. The Grecian Contributions. Few people would choose to argue, at least legitimately, that the ancient Greeks were not a heady bunch. They spearheaded an incredible number of things: geometry, philosophy, democracy, and, of course, the Olympic Games, just to scratch the surface. In addition to their outsized contributions in most fields, the Greeks played a very important role in the history of meteoritics. However, their legacy, from a meteoritic perspective, was considerably less helpful than it was in most other areas of science and the humanities. Early on, things were looking just dandy for what would become the study of meteorites when Diogenes of Apollonia reported the fall of a brown stone at Aegispotami around 465 BCE, and was clearly hip to its cosmic origin. Meteors are invisible stars that die out, like the fiery stone that fell to Earth near the Aegispotamus. Diogenes later wrote, "With the visible stars revolve stones which are invisible, and for that reason, nameless, they often fall on the ground and are extinguished, like the stone star that came down on fire at Aegispotami." Diogenes is honored for his early understanding and writings about the cosmic origin of this rock by having a type of meteorite, the Diogenites, named after him. Of course, we don't know if this alleged meteorite at Aegispotami was what we now know as a Diogenite, since humans plundered and destroyed it before it could be properly studied. But it is a nice gesture anyway, I think. Not bad for a man living approximately 2,000 years prior to humans realizing that Earth was not the center of the universe. However, Diogenes' ideas about the origins of rocks from the sky were not to last long in Greek academic circles, unfortunately. It is difficult to point to a single person who destroyed the idea of meteorites coming from beyond Earth, holding back the study of our solar system's origins for roughly 2 millennia, but I will do it anyway. It was Aristotle. I really hate to bag on someone who has exerted such incredible and mainly positive influence on almost every form of knowledge in Western culture. I really do. But misconceptions about the source of meteorites can be traced fairly directly back to Aristotle's tome, Meteorologica, in the 4th century BCE. Meteorologica is the oldest comprehensive treatise on what we now know as meteorology, or the study of atmosphere and weather. But if you stretch, really stretch, and put on your forensic etymology hat yet again, you may notice slight similarities in the words meteor, meteorite, and meteorology. It is subtle, but it is there, trust me. Essentially, every conceivable terrestrial and atmospheric phenomenon was addressed in Meteorologica, all somehow related back to interactions with the classical four elements, earth, water, air, and fire, along with Aristotle's added divine fifth substance to complete the special sauce, the ether. Aristotle preferred his take of mixes of dry, moist, hot, and cold to the classical element names, but this gets confusing very fast and is not of much relevance here. Regarding the topic of this book, however, the Big A thought the falling rocks and fireballs reported by his predecessors and contemporaries were either 1. Lifted into the air by great winds, as he specifically suggested for the aforementioned stone of Aegispotami, or 2. A combination of various exhalations from earth that, when mixed under the right conditions, materialized in the sublunary region of the Earth-Moon system. Why would one of these two possibilities be more likely than meteorites just coming from somewhere else in the solar system, you may ask? Chiefly, it seems that an external source of meteorites presented a bit of, flying rock in the ointment for Aristotle's grand vision of the universe. Aristotle believed that beyond Earth and the Moon was the region of the stars, an area of timeless perfection that was unchanging and unchangeable. This idea may sound very strange now, but considering he lived almost 2,000 years before the first telescope, I am willing to cut him some slack for his astronomical inaccuracies. Sure, this sounds romantic, but like most things romantic sounding, it is completely untrue. And since the basis for Aristotle's grand vision of the universe did not allow for anything dynamic beyond the moon's orbit, all of those damn falling rocks must be coming from Earth itself, somehow. Had Aristotle not been such an intellectual giant, his missteps on meteoritics would have been easier to ignore or replace by subsequent minds on the subject, but he was Aristotle, so going against him was, not logical. Aristotle is also credited with creating the first formal study of logic. It was difficult to get away from his mind shadow for a long, long time. Incredibly, it took until the scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries, thanks in large part to the invention of the telescope, for Aristotelian ideas of astronomy and physics to start to be supplanted. But even with humanity's vastly improved knowledge about the planets and their orbital relationship to the sun, rocks falling from the sky continued to be thought of as either forming on the ground and tossed about by strong winds, or sourced from earthly exhalations such as volcanic eruptions. Unfortunately, a millennia-long succession of academic A-listers provided credence to the idea that falling rocks could be sourced from terrestrial materials. Leading up to and during the Enlightenment, René Descartes and fellow Frenchman Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier both argued, about 100 years apart, that lightning and atmospheric dust could be the precursors to stones that then fell to Earth. And, since contemporary electrical experimentations, largely pioneered by the American polymath, Benjamin Franklin, showed that iron oxide could be converted into iron metal, some scientific squinting, hand-waving, and lightning could of course explain why chunks of iron metal were repeatedly seen falling from the sky. However, the most important continuation of Aristotle's erroneous notion of Earth-sourced falling rocks came from an unlikely source near the close of the 17th century. Someone with perhaps the most impressive scientific chops in history, the peerless Sir Isaac Newton. In what is arguably the most influential book in scientific history, Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, Newton established the foundation of classical mechanics, explained universal gravitation, and derived the laws of planetary motion. Not bad. In his second book, Optics, also one of the great works of science history, Newton, unfortunately, and incorrectly, describes how meteorites may be formed by material rising in dry air and mixing with other materials high in the atmosphere. Perhaps even more damaging to the study of meteoritics than Newton's inaccurate ideas on how meteorites were produced, Newton essentially ruled out any small bodies existing in the cosmos, stating that to make way for the regular and lasting motions of the planets and comets, it's necessary to empty the heavens of all matter, except, perhaps, some very thin vapors, steams, or effluvia arising from the atmospheres of the Earth, planets, and comets. A statement like this from the preeminent physics mind, probably ever, certainly did not help establish meteoritics as a science of extraterrestrial materials, since it now seemed that small extraterrestrial materials could not exist. As the thinking then went, if there could be no matter in space other than great bodies like stars and planets, then the rocks repeatedly reported falling from the sky on peasants are either, one, from Earth, or two, made up by said peasants for some short-lived attention. Even during a time of great scientific revolution, such as the Scientific Revolution, this was significant baggage to overcome. Revolutionary and enlightening setbacks. The periods historians discuss as the Scientific Revolution, beginning in the mid-17th century, shortly followed by the Enlightenment, were exceptionally exciting times for thinking folk. An incredible list of people made their mark on history during this time, and inconceivable progress was made not only on myriad scientific and social problems, but also, and maybe more important, how these problems were approached. According to philosopher Immanuel Kant, the motto for the entire period was Sapere Aude, which translates from Latin to dare to know, or more loosely, yet probably more on point, dare to think for yourself. However, in spite of all the revolutionary thinking that was happening during the Age of Reason, there really wasn't much revolutionary in it for the study of meteoritics, at least in the short term. While it was avant-garde to reject entrenched dogmas, it was also de rigueur to reject supposedly nonsensical stories, so there was not a lot of patience for simpleton farmers that told tales of flaming rocks falling from the sky. That type of thinking seemed like fantasy, and there was no room for fantasy in respectable scientific circles. The stones that made the difference. History is littered with stories from all continents of falling rocks from the sky, yet for centuries it was not widely agreed upon how this was happening. As chronicled above, Aristotle's philosophy required falling stones come from Earth. Newton's physics had emptied the heavens of all matter but large bodies and comets. And scientists like Lavoisier developed theories based on chemical and electrical experiments where stones could be created in the atmosphere. Given this, it is perhaps no surprise the source of meteorites was unknown to, or at least forgotten by, academia for millennia. But ultimately, the evidence kept coming. Lucky for us, it is hard to ignore the hypersonic chunks of rock and metal that keep pounding our planet. Whereas there are hundreds of meteoritic events described in history prior to our understanding of the source of flying rocks, the section below highlights a few of the events that either captured something about society at the time that they fell, or nudged the needle toward understanding the true source of meteorites. Nogata, Japan, May, 861. On the evening of what was probably May 19th, 861, the sky lit up and disturbed the rural area near the present-day city of Nogata on the island of Kyushu, Japan. The next morning, villagers came to find the source of the ruckus was a black stone at the bottom of a newly formed pit in the garden of the Suga Jinja Shinto Shrine. This event was not only significant to the inhabitants of the area, but it also happens to be the earliest witnessed fall of a meteorite where pieces are currently preserved. Subsequent scientific investigation showed that the Nogata meteorite is what is known as an ordinary chondrite and was just under 500 grams. More on meteoritic designations can be found in the appendix. Since the fall was accompanied by well-documented evidence that priests in the area accepted the rock as coming from the sky, one might think this represented a watershed moment in the history of meteoritics. Unfortunately, however, this early recognized meteorite played no role in the global understanding about the source of meteorites. But in more modern and happy news, the Suga Jinja Shrine now brings the meteorite out for public demonstration during the Grand Shrine Festival every 5 years. In October 2011, the festival celebrated the 1150th anniversary of the fall, and the Nogata Stone led a series of lavishly decorated carts holding the shrine treasures. Get your tickets now for the 1200th celebration in 2061. Ensisheim, Alsace Region, November 7th, 1492. More than 600 years after the Nogata Fall, and coincidentally the same year Chris Columbus was sailing the ocean blue to discover a continent that had been inhabited by humans for over 20,000 years, the Western world was literally rocked by the arrival of the Ensisheim meteorite. The Ensisheim fall occurred shortly before noon, catching people out in the fields of what is now far eastern France, to witness its landing and hear its thunderous boom, which was reported over multiple modern-day countries. The heavy black stone had created an approximately 1-meter-deep hole, and after curious townsfolk decided that was no place for their new friend to reside, they promptly removed the rock and immediately started helping themselves to pieces of it as souvenirs. Of its estimated original 135 kilograms, today the largest stone weighs in at about 56 kilograms, which, even in the metric system, is much less than half of its original weight. As Nogata is for the East, Ensisheim is the earliest witnessed fall in the West where pieces are preserved. However, whereas the fall of Nogata was essentially ignored by everyone but the local population, the Ensisheim occurrence became an instant sensation. At least as instant and sensational as anything could be in the late 1400s. With the help of numerous dedicated artworks, word of mouth, Twitter, and particularly the recent advent of the Gutenberg printing press, news of the fall raced across Europe. Arguably, the most important ears that the news fell upon were those of King Maximilian, who was told by his clever advisors that the stone was a sign of God's favor toward him in his recently begun campaign against the French. The pleased Max helped himself to a couple chunks of the stone and then instructed the main mass be taken to the local church as a testimony to what had happened, and as a demonstration of how little was understood about general physics at the time by the local population. The stone was reportedly chained to the church as to not wander about at night or perhaps return to the heavens in the same fiery manner by which it arrived on earth. Across Europe, there was little doubt that the fall at Ensisheim had happened. There were too many witnesses, and a massive, weird-looking chunk of rock chained to a church as evidence. However, because Europe was comparatively sparsely populated at the time, and population centers of more than a few scores of people were not incredibly abundant, other meteorites in the following decades and centuries were not quite so lucky in the observation department. Most reported falls after Ensisheim had limited witnesses, and almost all of these witnesses were rural farmers or other uneducated people. This is, of course, primarily because most people were rural farmers and uneducated at that time. Unfortunately, the sentiment in the ivory towers of academia was that a vast majority of people would say anything to get attention. As such, Reports of meteoritic interactions in the following four centuries were either completely ignored or cast away as senseless stories from attention-seeking simpletons with a flair for the dramatic. One particularly flagrant example of this unfortunate attitude was captured following a brilliant fireball with accompanying falling stones in southern France on July 24, 1790. Whereas this event was witnessed by thousands of people, and stones that fell were collected in multiple villages over a wide area, the scientific response to news of the event was published in nearby Montpellier in a report issued by the editor of the Journal des Sciences Utiles, Pierre Bertillon. How sad is it not to see a whole municipality attempt to certify the truth of folk tales? The philosophical reader will draw his own conclusions regarding this document, which attests to an apparently false fact, a physically impossible phenomenon. The same year, further insult to the concept of stones falling from the sky was added by Abbé Andreas Zava Stutz, the assistant director of the Imperial Natural History Collection in Vienna, when he penned a work with the classically dismissive title, On Some Stones Allegedly Fallen from Heaven. This paper discussed a collection of remarkably similar stories from the last few decades to the one above, although across various parts of Europe. Stutz opined, It was said that the iron fell from heaven. It may have been possible for even the most enlightened minds in Germany to have believed such things in 1751, due to the terrible ignorance then prevailing of natural history and practical physics. But in our time, it would be most unpardonable to regard such fairy tales as likely. And thank you, Herr Stutz, for that unhelpful mix of strange nationalism and intellectual elitism. However, as steadfast and flippant as these all-too-common sentiments of the mid to late 1700s from academics may sound, there were still a lot of people willing to search for answers using good scientific practice. One such example is Peter Simon Pallas, who, after learning about an approximately 1,600-pound, approximately 725-kilogram, mass of stone and iron found in the remote area of Siberia south of the village of Krasnoyarsk, dedicated much of 1772 to investigating the object. To reiterate, Pallas heard 1,600-pound blob of iron and remote Siberia and thought, road trip. But it was a productive road trip, to say the least. Pallas thoroughly described the strange object and its surrounding geology, keenly pointing out that there were no iron smelting operations anywhere near the region, and moving such a large mass of iron to that location would have been essentially impossible, especially given the remoteness and terrain of the area. Additionally, that part of Siberia is more than 1,500 miles from the nearest active volcano, discounting the theory that the iron mass was burped out by a volcano. Oh, and as it so happens, the native Tartars believed the mass to be a holy relic that fell from heaven. Pallas did not openly say that he agreed with the Tartars, but the alternatives were quite limited. After Pallas distributed samples around to the scientific centers of Europe, somehow the focus of the debate was not whether it came from the sky or not, but whether the iron mass was natural or if it had been previously smelted. One daring scientist named Franz Guzman was bold enough to suggest that the huge Krasnoyarsk stony iron object was flung down from above, citing similarities with the Rashina iron mass that was witnessed to have fallen in 1751 in Croatia. Guzman wrongly pronounced that the samples had been carried into the atmosphere and inflamed by lightning before they fell. But at least he was on the right track that they were falling from the sky. In addition to a number of unexplained oddities apparently falling from the sky around the globe, it was not lost on many of the more open-minded scholars of the time that the 1781 discovery of the planet Uranus, the first such discovery since antiquity, showed that space was not fully mapped or understood. I remember laughing aloud when I read in Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything that William Herschel wanted to give his new planet the name George in honor of King George III. Had that happened, I guess the mnemonic saying to remember planetary ordering would then have to be My very eager mother just sold out in order to gain favor with the king. I can't believe we have a stupid planet named George. And as the population covered more and more of the surface of the Earth, particularly Western Europe, which for good reason thought itself intellectual ground zero, more and more rocks falling from the sky were noticed and cataloged. These stories, over the ages, had too much in common to be ignored. This was especially true for the German physicist and musician Ernst Chladni. In early 1794, Chladni published the revolutionary, yet clunkily titled, On the Origin of the Iron Masses Found by Pallas and Others Similar to It, and on a Few Natural Phenomena Connected Therewith, which really set the field of meteoritics into motion. The time had finally come for the idea that rocks falling from the sky were coming from outer space. And while this idea was held back by the world's greatest philosopher, Aristotle, the world's greatest physicist, Newton, and the world's greatest chemist, Lavoisier, it would eventually be the thoughts from a master in acoustics that would resonate the loudest and truest on the origin of meteorites. In his work, Chladni masterfully disputed the common and spectacularly incorrect explanations of fireballs while compiling and discussing the incredible similarities of 18 witnessed falls spanning multiple centuries, languages, and regions of Europe. Since news of the remarkable 1790 fall in southern France, the stones from this fall are named Barbotin for a nearby village, discussed above, had not reached him, this was not even included in his report. The major theses of his work were 1. Masses of stone and iron can fall from the sky. 2. Fireballs are created due to frictional deceleration as said stone and iron materials enter the atmosphere. And 3. These materials originate in outer space and are not products of earthly processes, but were possibly from failed or disrupted planets. Whereas Chladni didn't make some now recognized errors in his work, the main ideas have more than withstood the test of time and still rest as the foundations of the field of meteoritics. As one might expect, Chladni's revolutionary ideas crashed straight into the face of conventional scholarly wisdom, and the responses and reviews for his work were almost uniformly negative. In addition to his revolutionary contributions to meteoritics, Chladni is widely considered the father of acoustics. However, even though he is considered a giant in both of these fields, Chladni never even received a university appointment. Until his death in 1827 at the age of 71, Chladni had to earn his living by giving lectures and concerts while traveling all over Europe with horse and carriage. But Chladni had time and truth on his side, and in short order, the gravity overlords provided multiple important and timely pieces of evidence that convinced many other academics to join the meteorite party. Siena, Italy, June 16, 1794. Just a couple of months following the publication of Chladni's seminal work, the lovely city of Siena, Italy, received an otherworldly gift. It is important to note that Chladni's book was only published in two cities, Riga, Latvia, and Leipzig, Germany. Since information did not get around all that fast in the 1700s, you can imagine that it took quite some time for his ideas to really spread around the academic world, making the timing of the Siena fall even more interesting and important. At around 7 o'clock in the evening, a rapidly approaching cloud from the north produced tremendous rumblings, red lightning, and a large shower of variously sized stones that fell on the outskirts of town. Crucially, this spectacular event was witnessed by hundreds of people, including local farmers, children, tourists, and university professors alike, meaning it was not going to go down as a made-up tale from a lonely attention hound. Immediately following the event, a well-respected Sienese professor named Ambrogio Soldani began cataloging reports and collecting samples from the fall. Astonishingly, within 3 months of the fall, Soldani published an almost 300-page book called On a Shower of Stones That Fell on the 16th of June at Siena. According to Ursula Marvin, the foremost authority on the history of meteoritics, Soldani's book decisively raised the topic of fallen stones from the level of folk tales to that of learned discourse. It is for this elevation of the topic that Marvin argues the fall at Siena was the most important historical meteorite fall. Incredibly, just 18 hours prior to the Siena fall, Mount Vesuvius, about 200 miles, 320 kilometers, to the southeast, started erupting. Explosive volcanic eruptions are not that frequent on human timescales, nor are large meteorite falls. And now, both were happening in the same general area at the very time we were realizing falling rocks are real, and finally, legitimately, trying to find out where they come from. Given these semi-paired events, one popular explanation for the now accepted falling rocks from the sky was volcanic activity. And while some working on the problem thought the rocks could have come from the obvious choice, Mount Vesuvius, others also raised the possibility that they came from volcanic activity on the moon, which had been reportedly witnessed by William Planet George Herschel in work published just a few years earlier. And while both of these volcanic ideas were ultimately incorrect, at least academia was thinking creatively about ways to explain rocks from the sky and not just dismissing them as imaginary objects or atmospheric concretions. A lunar volcanic source for fallen stones was a popular idea for quite some time, as it allowed for the noticeable lack of a terrestrial volcano at many places where stones were falling. The conversation had finally been started, but one step at a time. Wold Cottage, England, December 13, 1795. As we all know from watching decades of James Bond movies, most things of consequence in this world either occur on British soil or feature someone with a posh British accent. This stands true in the history of meteoritics. If the Siena fall started the intellectual ball rolling, said ball received an important goosing late in 1795 in the form of the meteorite fall at Wold Cottage. On December 13th, at around 3:30 p.m., an English plowman named John Shipley was outside in just the right place at just the right time. He was lucky enough to be one of the very few, if not the only person in history, to be sprayed with mud thrown up from a meteorite fall. Shipley was not the only witness to the fall, just the most proximal. Two other farmhands saw the event unfold in all its glory, and several others heard the ruckus the meteorite caused during its Yorkshire-bound plunge. The stone turned out to be a 56-pound, approximately 25-kilogram, meteorite, which still ranks as one of the larger falls in Europe. But what made Wold Cottage a truly important nugget in the history of meteoritics was not the size of the fall or the location. It was the subsequent literature concerning the event. Importantly, the owner of the land on which the Wold Cottage meteorite fell was one Captain Edward Topham, an accomplished writer and journalist known for his fashion-forward and mannerly approach to life among the English elite. His well-regarded standing in society was certainly a benefit for him during his life, but it turned out to be especially important for the future field of meteoritics as well. As soon as Topham became aware of the occurrence on his Yorkshire estate, he made haste in doing what good journalists do. He started asking questions and writing about what happened. He conducted interviews from many eyewitnesses and those who had come to see the rock shortly after it fell. The themes that kept coming up from his interviews. It was a day with no sign of thunder or lightning, yet the sound at the arrival of the stone reminded people of guns firing at sea. Many witnesses noted the strong smell of sulfur emanating from the fallen stone. The stone had a texture of gray granite, which is not present in the Yorkshire rolling hills in which it fell. In February 1796, about 3 months after the event, Topham's detailed description of the event from interviews and sworn testimony of multiple witnesses was published in a local newspaper. Whether or not Topham understood the scientific significance of the event, he certainly understood the significance of media attention to spread the word of important happenings to the masses, and just a small write-up in a local newspaper was not his style. As such, Topham transported the Wold Cottage stone out of the sleepy corner of Yorkshire where it fell to London, where it was prominently displayed, with his supporting literature, opposite a popular coffee house in the famed Piccadilly district. For the low, low price of a single shilling, you could get a view of the otherworldly stone and a handbill of information about how it arrived to Earth. A shilling was a unit of money equal to 48 farthing, or 12 pence, or, if you prefer, 1/20th of a sterling. If that all sounds confusing, it is. In 1796, a shilling would have been just slightly more than the fancy coffee across the street. Concurrent with the fall of Wold Cottage and its associated fanfare, courtesy of the respectable Captain Topham, another man with an incredibly reputable and British-sounding name, Edward King, was also moving the ball forward on the study of fallen rocks. In addition to his regal name, it certainly did not hurt that Edward King was a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Society of Antiquaries. Following reports of stones falling from the sky in Siena, King started thinking about and compiling various reports of fallen stones over history. In his 32-page work, aptly titled Remarks Concerning Stones Said to Have Fallen from the Clouds, Both in These Days and in Ancient Times, King succinctly describes the events of the then-recent fall of Siena, but also catalogues the many reports throughout history of falling stones. King delayed publication of his book twice. The first was to discuss the events at Wold Cottage, in which he, like Topham, sets out the geologic differences between the stone and the rocks it fell around. No such stone has ever been found before this time in Yorkshire or in any part of England, nor can I easily conceive that such a species of stone could be formed by art to impose upon the public, whether, therefore, it might or might not possibly be the effect of ashes flung out from Hecla and wafted to England, like those flung out from Vesuvius, and, as I am disposed to believe, wafted to Tuscany, I have nothing to affirm. Hecla is a periodically active Icelandic volcano. Iceland is home to the closest active volcanoes to England, yet Hecla is still somewhere around 1,000 miles, or 1,600 kilometers, from Yorkshire. I wish to be understood to preserve mere records, the full authority for which deserves to be investigated more and more. The second delay in publication was because King received a translation of Clodney's book that suggested that the falling rocks of interest were not of this planet. Eventually, King did publish, and while he openly admits that he and Clodney do not fully agree on the source, King preferred the idea that the falling stones were sourced from earthly volcanoes, he noted that Clodney's facts, which he affirms in support of his ideas, deserve much attention. Even though King ultimately came to the wrong conclusion, his landmark work was a critical catalog of some of the stories of fallen stones and some crucial observations about their likeness to one another. Importantly, King's work was the first book about meteorites to be written in English, and as such, it was read more extensively by, English speakers. King's book initially received a decidedly negative and a decidedly elitist and chauvinistic review in the July 1796 edition of The Gentleman's Magazine for King's willingness to admit the evidence of a few peasants or women. Gulp. Bad review or not, King's work was a success and was widely read. In one particularly stimulating twist, King's book inspired another English naturalist, William Bingley, to report on the fall of a stone he had witnessed in Pettiswood, Ireland in 1779. The Pettiswood meteorite is one of only six recognized meteorites from Ireland. Bingley wrote that he had not previously reported what he had seen because he feared ridicule. Directly referencing Topham's news of the Wold Cottage fall, Bingley wrote into, you guessed it, the Gentleman's Magazine with his impressively astute, somewhat erotic thoughts about the heritage of meteoritic materials. I am not without hope that, upon farther investigation by the learned, my cake and Captain Topham's loaf will be found to have both been baked in the same stupendous oven, according to the due course of nature. Weird sounding or not, Bingley was onto something. His cake was indeed baked with Topham's loaf, Palace's muffins, Soldani's panettone, and Clodney's dampfnudel. They were all made from extraterrestrial material, material that is distinct from the rocks we are familiar with here on Earth, and professionals and non-professionals alike were starting to take notice. Better living through chemistry. Alongside the eyebrow-raising discoveries in astronomy of never-before-noticed planets and growing ideas of otherworldly rocks pelting Earth from above, chemists were also busy doing their part in advancing the meteoritic cause. Toward the end of the 18th century, the field of chemistry was still in a primitive state when viewed from a modern lens. However, new elements were being discovered, and various gases and compounds were being isolated at a dizzying pace. By the close of the 18th century, it was possible to recognize differences in chemical compositions of certain rocks. And as curious scientists are wont to investigate curious objects, strange rocks reportedly falling from the sky and giant hunks of metal certainly qualified. Chemist Edward Howard was the first to document chemical differences in rocks that fell from the sky versus your run-of-the-mill, non-flying rocks. Among other things, Howard carefully utilized a newly developed chemical separation technique to show that rocks reported to have fallen from the sky had a lot of the element nickel in them. Rocks that did not fall from the sky contained far less, and in most cases, using his method, no detectable nickel. This finding and his report on the analysis presented powerful arguments that rocks that fall from the sky have similar chemical signatures, and those signatures were distinct from normal Earth rocks. Howard's report was titled, Experiments and Observations on Certain Stony and Metalline Substances, which at different times are said to have fallen on the Earth, also on various kinds of native iron. I just love the descriptive stream of consciousness titles 200 plus years ago. L'Aigle, Normandy, April 26th, 1803. The efforts of people like Pallas, Clodney, King, and Howard, mixed with well-timed natural events, had certainly started a conversation about falling rocks and where they came from. However, opposition to the idea that rocks could fall from outer space lingered. In 1803, a physics professor in Paris by the name of Joseph Izarn published a 422-page tome with a rambling title dedicated to summarizing the current academic opinions, of which there were many, on the origin of meteorites. Okay, here it is if you really want to hear it. On Stones Fallen from the Sky, Atmospheric Lithology Presenting the Advance of Science on the Phenomena of Lightning Stones, Showers of Stones, Stones Fallen from the Sky, etc. With many unedited observations, communicated by M.M. Pictet, Sage, Darcet, and Vauquelin, with an essay on the theory of the formation of these stones. Izarn was a member of the popular Formed in the Atmosphere camp, yet many others thought they must be volcanically produced or tossed up by hurricanes. One small problem with the hurricane hypothesis would have been the general lack of hurricanes in the times and places where stones were falling, but it was somehow an idea that had a following. There were a select few who subscribed to an extraterrestrial origin for the Falling Rocks, but this was certainly not the majority opinion, according to Izarn's writings. That majority opinion, however, was no match for the events to come. On April 26, 1803, a shower of nearly 3,000 stones opened up near the town of L'Aigle in Normandy, France. This remarkable event provided a number of things. First, it likely resulted in numerous pairs of soiled underpants, as the descriptions sound terrifying and involve terms like three enormous detonations in the sky and a shower of fire. Second, the event definitively resulted in abundant samples and eyewitnesses, both of which would become extremely important when the investigatory heroics of the incident began. Whereas the spectacular fall at L'Aigle was a big deal locally, the major national newspapers in Paris, which was less than 100 miles away from the fall, were silent on the subject. When word of the fall finally did reach the Parisian academic crowd, a renewed vigor for documentation and centralization, courtesy of the French Revolution, caused the Minister of Interior to hastily dispatch a young scientist named Jean-Baptiste Billot to Normandy for a bit of investigating and report writing. While the trip was not a long one, only 9 days, Billot's time in the field caused him to miss the birth of his only child. This was likely of no consequence to Jean-Antoine Chaptal, the man who dispatched Billot on the trip. After all, Chaptal was responsible for figuring out how to increase the alcohol content of wine, meaning he is personally responsible for tens of millions of births worldwide. So, a singular birth probably didn't seem all that important to him. As you may suspect, the outcome was not a boring, unimportant government report that was filed away in a desk drawer. The outcome was a thoroughly researched, comprehensive, and decisive report that was easily understandable to anyone. Quite simply, it was a document that changed the course of science. Billot began his report with an inspirational scientific call to arms about figuring out the mystery behind falling rocks. This easily could have been the inspiration for President Whitmore's famous speech in the 1996 movie Independence Day. Scientists of all classes, of all countries, have united their efforts upon this great question, guided not by jealous rivalry, but by the noble love of truth. Just to be clear, in Independence Day, we were not facing annihilation by meteorites. In that movie, we were facing annihilation from aliens. Following this stirring prose, Billot set the stage for his readers with hard evidence, courtesy of the work of Howard and others, noting the chemical similarities previous fallen stones had in common, and how these chemical signatures were notably different from common rocks. Billot then included testimonials of a wide variety of witnesses from the L'Aigle area, most of which had no connection to one another at all. The intentional diversity of witnesses included some who were irrefutable because of their status in society, and, as he put it in one case, a very respectable dame that has no interest to impress anybody. He found that regardless of their social status, the witnesses all told very similar stories of what had happened that day in April. In his report, Billot compared the chances of such unknowingly coordinated stories to the likelihood that a flash mob of Thriller would break out in the town 180 years before the song was written or the dance conceived. At least he should have. With these extensive interviews and some field work, Billot made maps of where stones fell, a near-perfect ellipse, and documented widespread reports of the sounds that accompanied the event. Of course, he also collected samples of weird-looking rocks dissimilar to anything in the local geology. To close his report, Billot reported on the chemical analysis of stones from L'Aigle and showed how they fit the same pattern as that noted in the earlier chemical evidence. Rocks from the sky were just simply different from rocks not from the sky. The Billot report had spoken, and people was starting to listen. It can be, and is, debated which person, event, or report was the true turning point for the science of meteoritics. Some say the Siena or Wold Cottage falls. Some the chemical analysis of Howard and colleagues. Some say Klotny's book, and yet others point at the Biot report. But as Mathieu Gounel of the National Museum of Natural History keenly points out in his 2006 work on the subject, meteoritics was not born only in a library at Göttingen where Klotny carefully peeped at ancient and modern sources, nor in a chemistry laboratory in London, but also on a road to L'Aigle and evoked by the delicate words of Jean-Baptiste Biot. Modern meteoritics plays a huge role in science, as it sits at the crossroads between many already broad disciplines, such as astronomy, chemistry, and geology. However, even after meteorites were recognized as scientific objects originating from outer space, the study of meteorites was still considered only a minor pursuit. It was not until our sights were set for landing on the moon that investigating meteorites was regarded as a respectable use of time. As such, the real push in the study of meteorites is limited to the last 50 to 60 years of research. In these more recent decades, however, we have learned an almost inconceivable amount about our solar system from these leftover scraps of rock. It was quite an adventure for meteorites to be recognized as the treasure trove of information they are, and scientists continue to demonstrate that these space rocks contain answers, or at least clues, to some of the biggest questions we ask about our surroundings and ourselves. But what is it about meteorites that allows us to address such questions? Why do these mysterious rocks from space contain answers to questions we cannot answer from common rocks indigenous to Earth? The abridged answer is that meteorites are ancient and largely unchanged. Certain types have never been melted since they formed over 4.5 billion years ago, and thus are excellent time capsules for the genesis of the solar system. For a more detailed answer as to why meteorites are such incredible vessels of information, the curious listener is pointed to the appendix of this book. The most primitive types of meteorites are so pristine, we essentially sample an unadulterated version of our parent molecular cloud from which the solar system formed. And it turns out that the seemingly simple ingredients of gas, ice, and dust in that molecular cloud set us on the winding and incredible path we took to rocky planets, water, and life.